the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 153, covering the week of January 14th through January 18th, 2019. Very glad to have you back on the program. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and of course, subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. If you go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook. You'll get on our email list, and you'll get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email, which includes a link to this podcast on Saturday or Sunday. Also, don't forget to download our mobile app. You can go to your favorite app store, whether it's Google Play or Apple App Store, and pick up the Abbeville Institute app. It is free of charge, so go on out there and get that. You'll have a mobile link to this podcast, as well as all of our lectures, now totaling over 200 of those, and a link to the website. So it's a great tool, free of charge. You just get the Abbeville Institute on the go, and it's a wonderful thing to have. Also remember that we exist on your generous contributions alone, so please consider making a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. Help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. And you can always get your Abbeville Institute apparel by going to abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a button that says support, and you'll have shop, and you click on that, you get your embroidered material. That's also where you can find our donor options. So you click on that as well under that support tab, and you'll find those donor options. You can donate monthly or annually. But those Abbeville Institute shirts and hats and all that stuff, it's great, great material, embroidered, high quality. So if you want to show your support for the Institute while you're out and about among your friends and family members, get your Abbeville Institute apparel. Okay, well, let's talk about the week that was at the Institute. Some really interesting articles this week, and I think that they all fit within a general theme of Southern identity. In fact, the first piece is an older essay by Richard Weaver. And the reason we rerun these things every now and then is because a lot of people haven't read this stuff. And of course, you know, Richard Weaver being one of the, if he had lived longer, would have been one of the deans of the modern Southern tradition, the exposition of that. And so Weaver had a lot to say about the South. Weaver was an interesting individual. And I think that one of the benefits of reading these older essays is that people can see the continuity between the Old South and the New South, and then, of course, into the modern era. And one of the things that that Weaver says, which I think is very important, is he says, look, it's virtually a truism in American political thinking that the South has been a kind of nation within a nation. This is the same thing Eugene Genovese said, but he said it about African Americans. But Weaver is saying the South is a nation within a nation. You have no doubt learned that nation is a hard thing to define in any ultimate sense. But taking the term in the practical, working sense usually employed, we can say that there are a number of evidences of Southern nationalism. The political unity of the section, often referred to by the phrase the Solid South, is a fact of considerable notoriety. Its ideological unity, or its common community of belief about certain ideas, certain institutions, and certain figures of history, is only a little behind the political unity. And the unity of its culture expressed in its way of life, its speech, its cookery, and its manners has maintained itself surprisingly in the face of a variety of conditions on the inside and considerable pressures from the outside. This is something we focus on a lot at the Abbeville Institute. In fact, it's our stated mission to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. This is exactly what we're talking about. For example, we just had a summer school on Southern music, which is part of that unity of the South. We've done summer schools, of course, on the Southern political tradition. We've done summer schools and conferences on literature. And that literature deals with all of these different phases, or aspects, I should say, of Southern culture. And so it's important to understand this tradition, and it's something that's being lost. And it's being lost because of the pieces we talk about twice in the week, Wednesday and Friday. There's a reason why this continuity is being lost, and it's coming from an outside force. But Weaver identifies several areas where the South has been able to maintain this continuity. He calls it an orientation toward the center, which is a characteristic of all high cultures, he calls it. So the South has a high culture. And of course, we all know the South is not monolithic. But he identifies certain areas where Southerners tend to identify. And of course, that tends to move to the center. He says, the first step toward understanding the peculiarities of the Southern mind and temper is to recognize that the South, as compared with the North, has a European culture, not European in the mature or highly developed sense, but more European than that which grew up north of the Potomac and Ohio Rivers, in several respects, even more European than that of New England. So, he talks about this, and I think that's something that you do find, as Southerners would venture out, whether it was to England. Clyde Wilson has talked about this with Pettigrew when he went to Spain. Southerners recognized aspects of their own life and elements of their own culture in these European areas. And it doesn't mean that they'd taken Europe whole cloth, because they didn't. But the aristocratic South is something that Mencken pointed out. And everyone pointed out that had a brain after the war was over. When the South lost, there was a certain part, a high-toned part of American culture that was lost. Washington, Jefferson, all of the founders from Virginia or the Carolinas would not have been the same if they had not been of this cavalier stock. This is something that David Hackett Fisher points out. That cavalier stock was much more European than the Puritan stock of New England. And certainly, in terms of their high-toned culture. And that high-toned culture produced, as Charles Sidner pointed out, some of the best men in American history. We wouldn't have the American War for Independence without this high-toned Southern stock. You needed it. It was necessary. And so it's important to understand that, that this high-toned Southern stock was in many ways the bedrock of the American political and social and economic order. The American War for Independence was a conservative independence. It wasn't revolutionary. There were certainly revolutionary aspects, or people that wanted revolutionary aspects, but the most revolutionary thing that the Americans did was get rid of the king. However, much of the culture of America never changed from that point forward, not until you had this great revolutionary period of the 1860s, when you started seeing vast changes to society, not just social changes, but political, economic changes. Those things started taking place, and of course, you started seeing this over time. It was already happening in other parts of the United States, but with that, there was a vast transformation with Reconstruction and the recreation of America, which was the stated goal for many of the Republicans at the time. Weaver goes on, whether the South was right or wrong in preserving so much of the European pattern is obviously a question of vast implications, which we cannot go into here. But I think it can be set down as one fact in the growing breach between North and South. The South retained an outlook which was characteristically European, while the North was developing in a direction away from this, was becoming more American, you might say. Now, this is an interesting point. I'm not so certain that the South was becoming, or the North was becoming, more American. I mean, this is something that the North would say during Reconstruction. They're Americanizing the South. The South was somehow retaining something that wasn't American. I would say that Washington, Jefferson, Madison, I mean, all of these individuals. Washington, though, more importantly, because he was this conservative. These people were American. They were distinctively American with European antecedents. And so you can't say that the North was more American than the South. In fact, I would suggest that the Jeffersonian tradition was more American than anything. I mean, it's what dominated America, this Jeffersonian worldview. I mean, the only thing that Jeffersonianism did not have 100% was the religious aspect, but which we'll talk about also with a piece for this week. But certainly, Jeffersonianism was an American position. Now, it's not to say it's an ism. I mean, we get into these things with these ideological underpinnings, ism. But certainly the Jeffersonian tradition, one might say, this federalism that that marked American political life, which was essentially imported from the way the Americans thought about the British Empire, and of course the English political tradition before this point, was very traditional in that way. Jefferson was a reformer within his own state, but beyond that, his interests stopped there. So that's certainly part of it. And this individualistic, the way that they looked at life, the frontier, all of these things. Washington was, in many ways, a frontiersman as well. So I'm not so certain that the South was less American than the North. In fact, you could say maybe the South was more American in its attachment to these ideals than the North. He also says, the second great factor in the molding of Southern unity and self-consciousness was the Civil War. Southerners are sometimes accused of knowing too much about the Civil War, of talking too much about it, of being unwilling to forget it. But there are several reasons why this rent looms very large in the Southerner's memory, and why he has little reluctance in referring to this war, although it was a contest in which he was defeated. To begin with, Southerners, or a great majority of them, always have believed that their part in the war was an honorable one. Far from regarding themselves as rebels, they felt that they were loyal to the original government. That is to say, they believed that they were fighting to defend the government as it was laid down at Philadelphia in 1787 and as recognized by various state ordinances of ratification. This was a government of restricted power, commissioned to do certain things which the states could not do for themselves, but strictly defined as to its authority. The theory of states' rights was a kind of political distributism, which opposed the idea of a powerful centralized government. The Southern theory, then as now, favored the maximum amount of self-determination by the states, and it included, as a kind of final guarantee that states' rights would be respected, the principle of state sovereignty, with its implied right of secession. In the Southern view, it was the North that was rebelling against this idea, which had been accepted by the members of the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Or to put it another way, the North was staging a revolution, the purpose of which was to do away with this older concept of the American government. So, I mean, this is true. I mean, this is something that first part, though, where the South considered their participation in this war an honorable one. You can't say that anymore. To say that you believe, if you're a Southerner and with Confederate ancestors, which there are millions of people in the United States with Confederate ancestors, that your ancestor was fighting an honorable cause, or that your ancestors were honorable for taking part in that conflict, now you're called all kinds of names for saying that. But this is a relatively recent development, one that's been created by a distorted view of American history. We don't consider our members of the founding generation to be dishonorable, many of whom owned slaves as well. In fact, every state in the Union that was formed and with the Articles of Confederation had slavery. It was only ended in Massachusetts first because a court decision did it, but the Massachusetts Assembly, the legislative body, did not end slavery. The Constitution itself did not end slavery. A Massachusetts court ended slavery in Massachusetts, and then it was a gradual process. But the fact is, do we consider these patriots dishonorable people for fighting for independence? No. I mean, no one would go back and say, you know what, some people do, those that are highly delusional with a political agenda. But most Americans don't go back and say, you know, George Washington was dishonorable because he had slaves and he was fighting for a slave-owning republic, which the United States was. A slaveholding federal republic. Nobody goes back and says that. The British had made slavery a key part of their, or at least abolition of slavery, a key part of their war effort. I mean, you found it in New York and Virginia. So were these people, in New York, they made it a key part. So were these New Yorkers dishonorable people because they were fighting in a state that contained slavery and were slaveholders, some of them? Were these people dishonorable? You would have to apply the same standard to the patriots of 1776 that you would to the patriots of 1861. the same standard. But we don't do that. We're uneven in our application of this faux disdain that we have now in America. He continues, in all great crisis of history where we have a legal principle challenged by a moral right, you find people flocking to both standards. The one side says it believes in the duty of upholding the law. The other side says it believes in the imperative necessity of change, even at the expense of revolution. Though the Civil War may not look quite so simple to us now, this is the way many people saw it. A number of years ago, Gerald Johnson wrote an ingenious little book on Southern secession in which he referred to it as the struggle between the law and the prophets. The South had the law and the North had the prophets in the form of the abolitionists and also of the advocateurs, both heard and unheard, of a strong central government, unimpeded by theories of states' rights. The legal aspects of an issue which have been so long decided can only have academic interest, but if any of you wish to see a statement of the South's legal position on state sovereignty and secession, the best source is a little book by a man named Bledsoe, A.T. Bledsoe. Is Davis a traitor? Bledsoe was a Kentuckian, and he brought to the task of writing his this defense an interesting set of qualifications. He was a lawyer, a professor of mathematics, and for 10 years had been a colleague of Lincoln at the bar of Springfield. Also, and probably this is pertinent to mention, since we're talking about here a metaphysical debate, he had written a book-length refutation of Jonathan Edwards' Freedom of the Will. I don't know whether it's true or not, but it has been said that the appearance of his Davis a traitor in 1866 was one of the things that made the North decide not to bring Davis to trial. At any rate, the failure to bring Davis to trial was naturally taken by the South as a sign that the North's legal case was too weak to be risked in court. These are the chief things causing Southerners to feel that whatever the claims of moral right and wrong, they had the law on their side. So this is something Southerners always said. Look, we may have been wrong. History may have proved us wrong, but we were right legally. We had the law on our side. We were doing what was right and fighting for English liberties, the tradition of English liberties, moving forward from 1776 to 1861. These are ancient constitutions. They didn't use that phrase, but that's essentially what they were saying. Same thing Patrick Henry said. And so, this is one thing that always held Southerners together. That Southerners had this attachment to the war. So you add this attachment to the war, this culture that is evident everywhere you go. I mean, even to this day, you still have a Southern culture, and people know it. People know it. So perhaps it is the war that brings the South together. I'm not so certain about this anymore because of the way that people are... people's opinion of the conflict is being so distorted now. But certainly, there was this attachment to the war and an understanding of the war that brought the South together. So I find this piece very interesting, that there's a Southern nation within a nation. There are regional cultures. You can still see it if you look at them. I mean, back in 2000, I've mentioned this before, I think, on this particular podcast, when the 2000 census was taken and people asked to identify their ethnic heritage, Southerners answered American. And, of course, you also had African-American in the South. And if you look at that map, all the Americans lived in the South. Everywhere else, you had Germans and Irish and all these. But Americans lived in the South. There was an identity with that, a regional identity. Place meant something. And this is important because what's happened in America since, in the last, say, 40 years, is that place, that identity, has been eroded, been worn away a little bit, has been knocked down slightly. And it's happening because of politics. because people have gotten so tied into these R and these D's. I'm a Republican. I'm a Democrat. That defines their philosophical existence. That didn't define a Southerner's existence. I mean, of course, Southerners voted Democrat. It was a solid South in terms of Democrat voting. But Southerners were willing to move that if the party left them. Southerners are less inclined to do that nowadays. The party has left the South. The Republican Party, Southerners who are so attached to the Republican Party, it's left the South. They give lip service to the South. They say things that Southerners will like because they know that they're going to get the South to vote for them. But the party has left the South. The party left, the various political parties have left. And Southerners were always willing, until recently, to say, you know what, we're just going to go our own way. It's going to go our own way. The Democrat Party's lost us. The Republican Party, whatever it is. The party has lost us. They haven't done it really with the Republican Party, but the Democrat Party, they were willing to break away from that several times throughout history. They were willing to go their own way and chart a new course. That's because they had a nation within a nation. It's because they had an independent stock, a commonality that was deeper than just some labor institution. It was a culture. It was a way of life. It was a societal view. And I think this is what's lost in the South. That's one of the reasons, again, the Abbeville Institute exists, is because to identify that and say, you know, this independent streak was a good thing in American history. It was a good thing. It was a way to correct this move towards centralization in America, which was not just political, but also, as Weaver talks about, industrial, economic. It was a way to slow that down. To say, you know, we have something valuable worth protecting here, and we're going to do it. You move into the 1930s, and Weaver brings this up, and the agrarians, and what they're saying about that. Their critique of America was that we're moving, it's not just political. Because they did talk about politics a bit in that. In fact, what they favored was a regional-type government. But it's culture that's being centralized. We're losing something in the South, the way of life, that was valuable and good. Certainly Southerners love modern conveniences. They love to have the things that industrialization has brought. But there is a downside. There is an expense to that. And part of that is that the Southern culture is being destroyed. And there are just, you know, superficial vestiges of it left. I mean, certainly, you know, Southern food is still there, Southern music. Southerners are still more religious, but we're becoming much more Midwestern, right? Southerners are believing, because this is what the Republican Party has done, that they're Mike Pence. And so that is part of the problem. Now, let's talk about the piece on... Well, first of all, I'll go back to the book review. But to say this, that the region mattered, I mean, when we get to the piece, the book review on Tuesday, that's going to mean something. But when I say the Republican Party was wearing this down, you have Clyde Wilson writing a piece about Trump and how the Trump administration has been this other in the Republican Party. And he's written a book. If you haven't purchased it, it's great. It's The Annals of the Stupid Party, Republicans Before Trump. And then, of course, you have Alana Mercer and the Trump Revolution. And what he's talking about here is that the Republican Party has always been about power. That's what it's always been about. It's just a faction. It's not really a party itself. It's an election machine, as he says. The idea is just to get elected so that you can get into power, not because of the principles that you support. Though, I mean, you could say that the Republicans of the 19th century, they certainly had principles that they had adhered to. Many of them did. But beyond that, for most of the Republicans, it was about power. It was about power. And by getting into power, they could do what they wanted, but it never really mattered about what the rank and file wanted. Particularly when you get moving forward into the 20th century. And so The Republicans don't know how to govern. The Republicans get into office and they had the Congress for 2 years, the executive branch, and they don't even know what to do. So, but they're told, Southerners are told that you need to be Republican. And of course, Trump has come in and he's sitting on two things he was fighting against, which of course, immigration and foreign policy. Or these are the two major issues. You know, how Southern, we could talk about foreign policy. We did a wonderful conference on the Southern non-interventionist tradition. We do know that Southerners did like to get involved in foreign wars. I mean, Southerners were interventionist people in the 20th century. They had bought into this Lincolnian America. I think Don Livingston is doing a great job of putting that into a book. But Southerners had bought into this Lincolnian America. There was either, you could either take a position where we're not going to do it or we are going to do it. And Southerners became ardent unionists. And we're going to be better unionists than in the North. We're going to be better Americans, better American nationalists than those in the North. We're going to really show our moral worth. We're going to put down the sword and we're going to become even better than we were before. But we do know that Southerners forged the direction of America even in the antebellum period. I mean, they were pushing America in different directions. But there was a strain, particularly a paleoconservative strain, against America, against American imperialism, against what is a democratic imperialism. And Southerners spoke out. I mean, look, you go back to the Vietnam era. Fulbright and others were saying they originally voted to get involved in the war, but then they said this is a bad idea. It's a bad idea. So I find this particular part of Southern history very interesting, and this particular part of American politics very interesting. And I think that this is what Paul Yarbrough gets into on Friday when his piece entitled Southern Conservatives, where he says Southerners have been told that the neoconservatives are right. They've been told how to think about themselves. They've been hoodwinked into being ashamed of who they are because the neocons told them so. And this book by Forrest Neighbors gets into that. You know, Forrest Neighbors is in Alaska. He's a northern conservative. He wrote this book on Reconstruction where he basically says, look, I love the South, but I love the South so much, I'm going to tell you Southerners how you're wrong and how you should live. How you should live. And you see this all the time, whether it's the political pundits. I mean, there are a couple of political pundits, and they take a lot of heat for this. Laura Ingraham, Tucker Carlson, who take the South for its worth and what it is. And, of course, that goes back to this very old, but the 1980s. For some of you listening to this, maybe you're younger. The 1980s, you may have been alive yet. But in the 80s, you had this split, this paleoconservative, neoconservative split, exemplified by Mel Bradford getting booted from his appointment as chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities before he even took office, but booted from that because the neoconservatives didn't like the fact that he had criticized Abraham Lincoln. So you have this interesting debate, political debate, and ideological debate in conservatism. It's been there for 30-plus years. In the mainstream faction. But Southerners are being told that, hey, look, you're the R or D. I mean, this is it. You're either a Republican or you're a Democrat. If you're a Republican, you're going to adhere to these particular things. And if your culture is against that or your culture doesn't fit with that, your culture is wrong. So that's this interesting part of the Southern tradition. Weaver gets into this, but he of course wrote that in the 1960s, long before any of these things happened. And I find this fascinating when you look at, you know, what Weaver is saying in 1960s and then, of course, the 1980s and the 1990s and 2000s and how these things have moved over time. I don't think Weaver could have anticipated the Republican Party being as ascendant as it was in the South. And, of course, the Republican vision of America taking over the South. As it has. And of course, again, you're either R or D. Now, place matters, but there's also principle. And in the last two pieces, and very quickly, the piece on Thursday is on Franklin Pierce. If you don't know anything about Franklin Pierce, you should. Franklin Pierce was very good friends with Jefferson Davis. Franklin Pierce was, there was a book published by the late Tom Fleming, not Tom Fleming of Chronicles, but Tom Fleming the historian. And it was about the war, and he placed the blame of the war on abolitionists. He said, look, these people were agitators. They were causing problems. Essentially, what he was doing was taking the very the National Democrat position of the 1850s and moving forward with it and saying, look, this actually had merit. I mean, these people were troublemakers at the time. And so understanding Franklin Pierce and understanding what was going on in America in the 1850s is interesting. I mean, Pierce was not a Southerner. He's from New Hampshire. And you can call him a doughface, a northern man of Southern principles. Maybe it wasn't Southern principles. Maybe it was just American principles. I think this particular piece by Connolly, his name is Connolly, was actually published at the Imaginative Conservative. And Clyde's piece was actually published at Reckoning. Give a plug to those websites. But one of the things you can say about Pierce is he was interested in the Union. He was interested in an American Union of North and South. He was a reconciliationist. This term has now become a bad word, but he was interested in people getting along and having a union that worked because it was decentralized. The union could work because no one section would enforce its imperialistic goals on the other. And so Pierce was highly critical of Yankees, essentially, is what he's critical of. And Nathaniel Hawthorne was too. He was against the war. I mean, these are interesting people coming out of New England that nobody knows much about. I mean, Pierce is almost always listed as one of the worst presidents in American history. I think he was one of the best. Without question, if you read his veto statements and you read what he had to say in his speeches, he's very much in line with the founding generation. An interesting guy, without question. And I think that because we get this, well, who are the best presidents? Well, look at these guys. We got these guys on the bottom because they stink. They didn't do anything. They didn't have a legislative agenda. This is the kind of stuff, this is very Yankee, if you think about it, what's going on there. It's Lincolnian. We shouldn't do that. We should critically analyze these people for what they were. I mean, Andrew Johnson's another one we've already talked about that gets a bad rap. But perhaps Andrew Johnson and the progressives were interested in Andrew Johnson. They said he did get a... I mean, maybe this guy's strict adhered to the Constitution when he's president. He's actually trying to do a good job. And we get this skewed vision of Andrew Johnson because of the radicals. And of course, when we get to the Reconstruction, the modern interpretation, well, Johnson was just a racist. Franklin Pierce was just a racist. So you can't... None of the things these people said are worth anything. I mean, it's an anti-intellectual argument. But that's what people use. It's sad. When you think about it, really, we've gotten to a point where nobody can have an intellectual argument anymore. You just name call. And this is what Yarbrough says too. I mean, you just call somebody a racist, and then the debate stops there because nobody can get. If you can't refute what they're saying, just call them a name. And this is what happens all the time. I mean, could we discuss Franklin Pierce and the merits of his positions without just calling him a name? Same thing with Andrew Johnson. Same thing with any of these people. Any of these people we're talking about. Richard Weaver, I mean, any of these people. But place matters, and there was a strain, though, of New England that was a little different than the rest. And that said, the last piece of the week is by John Devaney. It's a book review of The Catholic's Lost Cause. Interesting book. It goes into Catholics in South Carolina and the American South. It's written by Adam Tate. And published by University of Notre Dame Press just last year. Interesting book. And Devaney does a very good job of bringing this out where region matters and place matters. He talks about Boston Catholics compared to South Carolina Catholics. And I think that's an important distinction to make. The culture of an area matters. And of course, Catholics did face, at times, a lot of opposition in the South. Where I live, Catholics moved in the early 20th century. And they were shunned. They were ostracized. The Catholic Church put a church here and also had a convent. And at the time, you know, this area, they weren't well received. And then there was the flu outbreak of the post-World War I period. And they moved into early 20th century flu outbreak. And the nuns were some of the most dedicated ministers of the sick. And so from that point forward, the Catholic Church is well received, well accepted in this community. And part of the goal, of course, of the Catholic Church here was to go out into the rural areas. There were a lot of African Americans in this area that became Catholic because of the influence of the church and going into rural areas. But that said, I mean, the church was highly involved in ministering to the sick. And so that was part of their appeal. And but John brings up a really interesting point that, you have Boston Catholics still were Puritan Yankee in many ways, whereas South Carolina Catholics were different because they were South Carolinian. This culture, this regional culture mattered. And these South Carolina Catholics looked at the South not as monolithic, but they took this federalism down to a much more local level. We have Charleston was the holy city. We have all these different denominations. We can all coexist in a very much federal structure, and we can enrich the culture of the area with all these different things as long as we recognize it. Yes, we're Southern first and foremost, and then we have our religion, and we can all get along that way with a decentralized system. There were Catholics who ardently supported the war in the South, without question. So this is an interesting book. I think one that's neglected, and I think Adam Tate has done a great job, in bringing this out. And of course, John Devaney for writing a book review on this. But all that said, Southern identity, Southern tradition, very important. It's the overarching theme of the Abbeville Institute, the overarching mission of our group, is to explore what's true and valuable in that. And I think that when you read this Weaver essay and then you look at what's happening here, politics, culture, whatever it is, the preservation of that culture needs to be paramount. And don't get caught up in this R&D stuff. I mean, if you're a political animal, don't get caught up in that stuff. Think about culture first and foremost. Think about social structure, and it'll make you a much more independent thinker moving forward. Until next time, good day.